This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams and Glyn Lavender.
Hi, and welcome to episode 351 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuttersIncPodcast.com, and joining me via Skype from Melbourne once again, Glyn Lavender from creativephotoworkshops.com.au. How are you?
Oh, how quickly they forget.
How quickly.
No,
How are you?
I'm on my last legs, mate.
Are you?
I am.
Why is that?
School holidays.
Right.
I'm 2.5 weeks in.
Right.
There's light at the end of the tunnel.
Excellent.
It's like 3 days of school holidays, then a weekend, then they're back to school.
Yep.
But to make matters worse, on the last day of school holidays, my wife goes away for 3 weeks.
Oy, oy, oy.
So, yeah, I get with them during the day, but I'm stuck with them at night. I could tell you, there's been name-calling and hair-pulling and screeching and tears and running around the room, banging into stuff and screaming about my turn for Pokemon, and that's just me.
Yeah.
And the kids have been far worse. You know? It's just been the Helen Wheels, I think her name is.
Right.
Oh, yeah. So I'm... quite ready for the respite of either dementia or school.
Or the resumption of school.
And the only thing that scares me more is knowing this is the last term before the big sort of 7 week break.
The big break
at the end of the year.
Yeah.
It's a daunting thing to look at. I'm wondering if I can pluck in a couple of overseas trips in that space. No, honey, I've got no choice. I've got to go. Have you been? The world of the internet wants to know.
Yeah.
Your bike.
I was just about to say that we were only commenting at work yesterday about the fact that my bike's off the road and school holidays are just starting. And I was saying, ripped off! The only 2 weeks where there's no traffic on the road and I don't have my wheels. Just totally ripped off. Man. So the latest is basically, I don't think there's been any news beyond what we already knew last week, which is, although... We recorded Thursday night. So Friday, the word came through that, yes, Triumph have agreed to pay not only parts but labour as well.
Ah, so you're triumphant.
Yes. So the order went off to England on Friday. The importer in Melbourne says that in his estimation, we should be looking at parts in the country by next Monday, which is the 3rd of October, I think it is. Which, of course, happens to be a public holiday in New South Wales, but not in Victoria. So that's good because it means they can ship the parts on the Monday. They should arrive here on the Tuesday or the Wednesday morning at the latest. And then hopefully the bike will be ready by Friday or the Saturday towards the end of next week. So
nice.
Yeah, so that's the latest. So, you know,
there's light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels like a long way off for me, but it's getting there. So, yeah. How's your week been?
You know, it's been non-photographic.
Oh, really?
Well, I had one workshop, but there was only how to use your camera, so there's not really anything photographic in that.
Right.
Just talking about.
No hopelessly incompetent but funny stories to tell?
No, there were mostly, well, you know... I had to phrase it in a nice way. It's hard to imagine. No, that's not. It never ceases to amaze. That's probably just how little understanding there is about photography.
Yeah.
Over something that's, and how people make it so stressful and overthink the process so much.
Right.
When it's really a fairly simplistic, three little elements on a balancing scale, effectively.
Yeah.
And how people who have been shooting for a long time with film cameras,
yep,
saying they were necessarily competent in those days, but at least were using cameras,
yep,
fail completely to grasp that it's no different when it comes to digital and the principles of taking a photo.
Yeah, that bit is odd.
Yeah.
I mean, in general, someone who's coming to photography, you know, with no past experience, I can understand it being a little daunting.
But there's not so much daunting. It's the fact that you try and explain what a shutter speed does and how it can either freeze or blur movement. And the concept just doesn't sink in.
Yeah, right.
That, like, okay, like, if you have the shutter open for half a second and I move my hand, that movement will show in your photo.
Yeah.
Oh, and they're still like, no. not saying this group on the weekend were like that, but that's, I get that a lot. They just don't grasp that simple concept, you know.
Mm.
But anyway.
I guess each to their own, I guess. Hopefully.
Now, you've been cheating on me out here.
Oh, yes. Coming up in this episode, I will be talking to Craig Wetchen.
Who?
Craig Wetchen, Victorian photographer. We spoke about him probably 18 months ago. He was starting a project, a personal project that kind of grew into something much bigger, where he was photographing men in their sheds. And this, well, I don't want to spoil the whole story, but...
No, but you've been cheating on me. You've been talking to other men behind my back.
That's right, yes.
Because you didn't invite me to talk to him, did you?
If you will recall, the very last thing I asked you at the end of the last episode was what he got on Saturday. And you said,
you'd already got the whole thing set up. So you set everything up at a time you knew I'd be working, so I couldn't come along.
No.
And join in. You didn't say, Glenn, I've got a chance to interview Craig. When suits you, dude?
No, because it was more about when did it suit Craig.
Craig? And if you're listening, Craig. Craig's a lovely guy. So I'm looking forward to not listening to the podcast and not hearing what he has to say.
Of course you are.
After the bit where you can insert the bit where he's supposed, where we pretend we're talking to him, did you pretend you're talking to him like tonight?
No.
The podcast?
No.
So after you've inserted that bit, tell me what interesting bits you got.
Oh, well, it was just a case of hearing the story from him firsthand, you know, and how it started off and how it grew into something bigger. And I'm not going to spoil all the details because
that's why I said say it after. You played the bit.
Well, I haven't played the bit yet.
I know. That's the whole point of the after. I'm giving up. So
you'll just have to listen to the episode when it's released.
Not going
to
happen. Transcribe it into Word form for me and I might read it.
Right. Put it through Google Translate.
So what we got? What we got to talk about today? Anything exciting?
No, not a lot. I did see on DP Review this week that Snapchat,
the DP Review
of all people, have come out with a hardware product. Snapchat hardware. How does that work? Hey,
is it an upskirt camera?
I like your thinking, but no.
So a camera in shoes that you can sort of it seems like the sort of level of Snapchat, doesn't it?
Well, you're not far off. They're called spectacles, and they're a pair of glasses with a camera built in.
What?
I can tell you're riveted. Well, I don't know. It's kind of like Google Glass, except way less discreet. Go and have a look.
Are they like Elton John glasses?
Oh, very much. Very much.
So they're really sort of.
I think he was on the design team.
They're good for orgies or something. When you got like, you're glamming up anyway.
Yeah,
exactly. Trying to make yourself look good for the opposites, well, not necessarily even the opposites.
Exactly. So they're not at all discreet. There is no way that you are going to wear these in public and not have anybody realize that you're filming them. And it's essentially like a replacement for a GoPro, I guess. It gives, you know, the viewer the first person view as you experienced whatever it is that you're doing whilst you were wearing said spectacles. So there's a little promo video in the link for anyone that wants to check it out. But it just seems like an odd thing for something like, you know, a platform like Snapchat to come out with. Like I don't expect web platforms like Snapchat to go developing hardware.
Hmm.
But, hey,
well, yeah,
who knows? Who knows?
If you've got glasses that can see what drones are seeing and glasses that can see what you're seeing, which is probably not uncommon, I guess. But it's wearables is the way of the future, isn't it?
Well, I guess, that's an interesting thing. I hadn't thought of them as wearables in the context of, you know, the category of hardware that is now, that is now being known as wearables. But, yes, I guess they do fall into that category.
Because they're glasses, dude, and you wear them. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It wasn't a huge leap.
No, it wasn't, but it was a leap I hadn't yet taken.
I'm not pushing the boundaries of technology ideas you see. funnily enough, I was looking up on the interwebs tonight. I was searching up photography podcasts, world's best photography podcasts, linked with the word Shutters Inc. to see how many times we're not mentioned.
And
in the world, and we're not mentioned in lots of them.
Right,
isn't that fabulous? Some of the best lists of photography podcasts,
and we don't count.
We don't even get looking.
We're flying under the radar, dude. That's us.
There was one top 24 plus one. Right. We managed to get that one, and we weren't even the plus one.
All right.
Which is nigh on a miracle itself, you know?
Yeah, right. Oh, dear.
We should put up our own list.
Top
podcast we record. Number one. And now, speaking of this, yeah. I did come across this whilst searching the interwebs.
Yeah.
Happy Snaps Photography Podcast.
Yeah, that's long defunct.
What is that?
Long defunct.
So even if we were to say the best photography podcast you've recorded, you've cheated and got another one anyway.
No, it died a long time ago.
Well, not obvious with a name like that, but go on.
So back in 2005 when I started podcasting, I was put in touch with Shelton by a then mate of mine here in Sydney, who said to me, if you want to do a photography podcast, I can put you in touch with this guy in Melbourne who'd really love to do one. And I went, oh, okay. So that's how I came to meet Shelton. And I, you know, Shelton and I spoke over the phone and over the internet for probably 18 months before I even met him. And we started out with two separate podcasts, one called Happy Snaps and one called Shutters Inc. And the idea was that Happy Snaps was very much tailored at the newbie photographer, and Shutters Inc. was meant to be for more advanced photographers and was going to cover more technical information, where Happy Snaps was going to be more, you know, understanding shutter speed, ISO and aperture, and, you know, looking at new cameras hitting the market. And very quickly we realized that there was just not enough material to keep two podcasts running, so we merged it all into Shutters Inc.
There's barely enough to keep this one running.
That's right. So that's the history of Happy Snaps.
How many episodes did you do? Three?
Do you know what? I'd have to go back and look it up, but I'd reckon maybe 20 at a guess.
Really? Are they still available? Online, I'd like. That's one I could have a good laugh. Listen to
not online, but I've still got the files here. I could dig them out for you and send them to you if you really want.
I reckon you should cut out excerpts of the worst bits of each one and insert them in the middle of ours, because by comparison, we may start to look good.
Right.
You know. It's the old Rodney Dangerfield theory that if you want to appear thin, hang around with people fatter than yourself.
Right.
If we want to appear good, play the lowlights of some of our other stuff. I'm going to start posting up my really bad pictures. Because by comparison, my good stuff's going to look really good.
Okay.
So Happy Snaps, eh? There we are. So it's still being talked about on the internet.
Well, there you go. Nothing dies on the internet.
Nothing dies on the internet.
That's it. Carl sent us a link. Join filmmaker and photographer Aaron Grimes in travels through New Zealand. And this was just a video hosted on, I can't even remember where it was hosted.
It was on createadobe.com. Yeah.
And just a video that this guy's put together. He's got a UAV. Which he's flown around New Zealand and shot a heap of
UAV.
Footage. Drone.
You're such a tosser. Oh, let's call it a UAV. Let's not use the name everybody now uses generically.
Okay.
Let's call it a UAV.
Fine.
Because it's just the audio tech.
Fine. I'll be wrong like the rest of you. So anyway, so yeah, it's just a short video of this guy's travels around New Zealand. There's some nice footage in there, so we'll put that link in the show notes. Thank you, Carl. Rob Coates wrote to us and said, "G'day, Bruce and Glenn. I received this via a Flickr mail today and thought you might want to mention it. Regards, Rob." And this was, just another alternative, like a Gorillapod, but a completely different approach. It's like a ratchet strap, basically.
Like a Gorillapod. What's that?
Well, it's like a
and Gorillapod come together to form a tripod now, like they've done with that phone company.
Like a Gorillapod in the sense that it is a, you know, easy to carry, small, flexible alternative to a tripod. But this one is basically just like a ratchet strap that you can strap to, you know, fence posts and handrails and things like that. And it has, you know, the ubiquitous 3/8 inch threaded mount on the top of it so that you can thread it into the bottom of your camera. So, yeah. Thanks, Rob.
Yeah, but so it got 471% funded.
Yep.
Okay. It raised $38,000.
Yep.
So this is all this stuff. This is a company. Okay? This is all these people now using Indiegogo to basically marketing and get money up front for the stuff. And what I really find bizarre is they've got this thing about media. They've got this little tag media, and there's nothing you can actually click on.
Right.
But they've listed like every name of brand of camera gear and website. So, but they're just going for, I don't know if there's any actual association with any of these companies.
Right.
And whether they're just doing that to try and get people to SEO it or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, it looks, it's a strap with a strappy thing.
The thing that gets me, right, is that if you were even moderately handy, you could head down to your nearest Bunnings/insert local hardware store name here and buy all the parts necessary to build this for probably about $10 or $15.
Yeah.
Like really, you know, if you really put your mind to it, it wouldn't be that hard to construct this.
I agree. It's just bizarre. And once again, this is some mob out of Hong Kong. It's just surprising how much things get funded on these places without necessarily a lot of follow up to see. Okay, now just what's actually happening, what's going on. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, somewhere back along the track, I don't know, 2 years ago maybe, someone sent us a link to another DIY project. Actually, it was a DIY project. I think it was on DIYphotography.net, and it was essentially like a Gorillapod version of a monopod that simply used a piece of copper bar inside a piece of plastic tubing, and then with your 3/8 inch thread stuck into one end of it. And so because of the, you know, flexible, malleable nature of the copper bar inside the rubber pipe, you could basically just wrap it around a tree or a fence post or whatever, thread your, you know, camera into the 3/8 inch thread and off you go. I mean, that kind of stuff, I think that's awesome. You know, you don't need a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo to spread an idea like that. This is just profiteering. But anyway. But hey, you know, Rob, if it floats your boat, great.
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
We're all for boats floating here.
Of course. What were you going to say?
I think I'm finished.
You think you're finished. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. No, there was something I was going to say.
Right.
But it's gone.
Okay. And Adam sent us a story from Petapixel, the Kodak Tower, lit by 2,800 people with flashes and flashlights. My question is, why? Just because
it's a bit flat.
You can.
It's a bit flat.
You should.
You put a bit of angle on there, got a bit of texture, a bit of definition.
I'm not sure exactly what they were trying to prove. It said in the story, for their 32nd annual Big Shot Nighttime Community Photo Project this year, the folks over at RIT decided to light the iconic 19-story Kodak Tower skyscraper at night by hand with the help of 2,800 volunteers holding flashes and flashlights. And there is a, a video in the story, which is actually shot from up on the tower looking down at the people as they set off all their flashlights and torches, which is kind of funky because the overwhelming influx of light hitting the camera that's filming it causes everything else in the cityscape to go dark. But, yeah, it's interesting, but... Yeah.
I mean, I guess as a social outing, it could have been fun. But as a bit of fun to get the people together to have some fun with photography, there's nothing wrong with that.
It's not unlike the people with cameras thing that you did a couple of weekends ago.
Yeah, but in this case, it might be good. No, but I mean, yeah, get a whole bunch of people together, have some fun. There's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's all I've got on my list. What do you got on your list?
Oh, I've got a little couple of bits and pieces. I saw this thing today, an interview at Photokina with Olympus.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought this should tweak your little nerdy brain.
Oh, okay.
To the max. In that Olympus has stated that image stabilization will never be able to achieve more than 6.5 stops of correction.
Oh, okay.
Because of the Earth's rotation.
Oh, wow.
So the Earth's rotation starts to come into play with image stabilization, where it can no longer work the axis because of the gravitational of the shift of the Earth's rotation.
Right.
How astounding is that? That's just like...
Wow.
And the fact that they've even calculated this and figured it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's. I mean, Olympus are claiming their new cameras have 6.5 stops.
Wow.
The new camera lens combination.
Wow.
Have 6.5 stops because their lens has got some new special tweaky stuff in it as well.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and so 6.5 stops and that's it. We've tapped out.
Funny that you should mention that because my A850, which is now a 7 or 8 year old camera, the vibration control that's built into the body is good for about 2 stops. And one of the specs that I noticed last week with the announcement of the forthcoming A99 Mark II from Sony is that the 5-axis stabilization that's built into that camera will offer up to 4 stops of, you know, correction.
Yeah.
Which I was kind of, I thought was cool, but I didn't mention it last week, and I'm kind of glad that I didn't because now, you know, Olympus have come out and said they can offer 6 stops.
It's like the 3-minute abs.
What are the 3-minute abs?
Well, you know, you can never come out with a video for like 5-minute abs because as soon as you do, someone's going to come out with a video for 4-minute abs and no one's going to buy your video anymore.
Yeah, right.
And so as soon as 4-minute abs, it's going to be 3-minute abs.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'll be the 30-second abs. Yeah. It's the same thing, you know.
I want the do-nothing abs.
Yeah, the eat chocolate and beer abs, please.
That's called
a slab more than an ab. It's an ab, but with a slur.
That's right. Some of the guys at work are having a competition at the moment to see who can get their abs into the best shape by the beginning of December. And about 3 days after they started this challenge, my boss walks in with a tray full of donuts. Uh-huh. And I've come into work that day and they've gone, "Oh, Bruce, have a sugar, have a not sugar-free, what did they call them? I think it was like, it was either a sugar-free or fat-free donut or something. They were trying to justify the fact that they'd got donuts and they were scoffing their faces.
It's got to be some sort of some crime against humanity to have a sugar-free, fat-free donut.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Isn't that called cardboard?
Yeah, something like that.
Or was it carb-board?
Yeah.
Who knows? So I thought that was interesting that the rotation of the Earth becomes a problem with image stabilization.
Yeah, right.
Which is astounding. Then I come across this pretty clever little idea that I figured anyone who's got a bit of a home studio going with like natural window lighting, could take this idea and sort of develop it for their own space. It's these guys who have this rather large natural light studio and wanted to find ways to shape the light.
Okay.
Or control the light in a reasonably cost-effective manner. And basically they put up this little grid system on the window and Velcro panels.
Oh,
so they
nice.
could pull out like strip lights, cross lights, big light source, small light sources, horizontal or vertical strip lights, spotlights, all by pulling off different Velcro panels or different panels on the window.
That's cool.
I thought it's clever. I mean, I don't like the example photos. I think the example photos don't really – do the system justice.
No, but the concept is sound.
But the concept is fabulous, yeah. I thought, well, that's really clever. Yeah, really, really clever.
Definitely.
So I thought, well, that's cool. So, I mean, that's something, once again, one of those easy DIY kind of projects too, you'd imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're even, you know, semi-moderately skilled, so I'd pay someone. But if you had any form of skills whatsoever, that'd be a really kind of handy little thing to do. If you want to use this big light source area, but trying to pull curtains closed, which gives you limitations and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
that was kind of nice.
Yeah, nice.
And then Google, our lovely friends at Google, the Google Brain team has announced that their software can now 94% accurately describe photographs.
Oh, this was on DP Review. I saw that.
So it could be, as their example is, there's a picture of a person on a beach flying a kite.
Yep.
And the software automatically says a person on a beach flying a kite.
Yep.
But I figured for tags, this would be the perfect tagging system.
Yeah.
Without you, imagine that we talked about before, you've got these 10,000 photos, you need to tag them all.
Yeah.
But if the software could analyze them with that sort of accuracy.
Yeah.
Yeah, 94%. Yeah, you're only looking at 360 images that wouldn't be tagged.
Yep, or tagged incorrectly. Yep.
Yeah, tagged incorrectly, and then out of 6,000.
Yeah,
away you go, 10,000. So it was really rather cool. It shows kind of the future. Things like hashtags for Instagram and all that sort of stuff. It's all going to be automated.
Yeah.
It's got two brown bears sitting on top of rocks.
But the whole thing about this technology is it will potentially, at some point down the track, render the whole concept of hashtags pointless.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you won't need to hashtag anything because...
You'd hashtag things if it did... example...
You would hashtag things that weren't visually recognizable.
Yeah, exactly. So if you want to hashtag a particular Instagram group as an example...
Yeah.
Like black and white people, so there'd be that sort of stuff, but all the other stuff that could still get connections with people, kids flying dogs over cliffs or something kind of thing.
What?
Because that's a thing,
right?
Yeah, that people would be able to find that stuff, you know.
Yeah, right.
So I thought it was really just once again just showing the amazing age that we're in as far as how technology is changing stuff.
AI is going to just change the landscape in humongous ways in the next 10 years.
Artificial intelligence probably will as well.
That too.
Yeah, both of those. But yes, but even in something that's only developed in the last few years, things like hashtags and blah, 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 already they're having this monumental shift.
Yeah.
Yeah, where stuff that used to take forever to change is now changing so fast. It was this, now it's this, now it's this, now it's that.
Yep.
Now it's done for you. Yeah, bang, bang, bing, bang, and bong, effectively.
Yeah.
Quite amazing. Then I came across two things that kind of creeped me out just a little bit, I've got to tell you.
Okay.
One was a wedding full of dogs. And by dogs, I mean these people decided instead of having flowers,
right,
they'd have puppies that they could adopt out.
Right.
So that all the bridesmaids are posing with puppies.
Oh, she's got a nice pair of puppies.
They haven't got their puppies out. Exactly. They're holding onto puppies, showing the puppies off for the camera, and talking about the puppies and hoping someone will come along and grab the puppies. I'm guessing. it's rather bizarre.
It strikes me as something that could potentially go horribly wrong.
And it strikes me as something in the way of just grabbing social media attention.
Oh, well, that too.
I mean, because this thing on Facebook, on this, has been shared zero times. It's been zero retweeted.
Right.
But it has had 61 Google Plus shares.
Right.
So Google Plus people obviously like the puppies.
Yeah.
Facebook, Twitter, not so keen.
Is it just me, or does every single photograph in this collection lack a black point?
What's a black point?
At least one pixel in the image that's black.
You have to understand these are wedding photos.
Right.
Arty farty.
Right. Okay.
All about the bouquet. All about the smell, the bouquet. It's all about the
smell
presets.
Of fresh puppies.
It's all about the presets to make it light and fluffy. No black points.
Oh,
thank
okay.
you very much. Right. Because not wearing black suits, which doesn't help.
No.
but yeah, even the black bits are light.
Yes, that's right.
So that's just the obviously that person's style, that person's look.
Look, you know what? There will always be people that will look at those wedding photos and go, "Oh, that's so cute.
I want puppies for my wedding too."
Yeah. So yeah, I can see that, you know, chicks will fall for it.
Yeah, well, it's the same reason we men get dogs, isn't it?
Maybe.
And so that kind of thought, oh, really? But now the thing that kind of freaked me out the most was I saw this photograph in The Guardian from the top 20 photos of the week of these people watching the movie Jaws.
Right.
Whilst floating on inflatable seats in a swimming pool.
Nice.
In this really cool old swimming pool in England, I got to say.
Wow.
But I remember as a kid.
Yeah.
Swimming in my backyard above ground, little round 5 foot by 5 foot swimming pool at night or with my eyes closed underwater, I would just about be petrified that Jaws was going up behind me. In that little backyard, I could only imagine laying there in similar things that are being bitten apart by Jaws.
Yeah.
That this is going to freak you out.
Yeah.
It freaks me out just looking at it. But a cool shot, though.
Yeah.
It reminds me very much of those shots of the back in the day of 3D movie cinemas when they started.
Everyone's sitting there with their red and blue glasses on. Yeah.
It's kind of cool. So I kind of like that this week as
I
well.
I love the building.
The building's awesome, isn't it?
It's great.
Very cool indeed.
Yeah.
But that's it. That's all I got. Right. I did do a little poll on Facebook.
Yeah,
and just to see what got people interested about Photokina, what had tweaked people's interest.
Yeah.
And I would say probably the two biggest things was the Fuji GFX50, the new medium format camera.
Yep,
loving that. I've already told Fuji I'd like to test one when it comes out next year. I put myself in the back of the line with all the other 3,000 other people.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking that's going to be somewhere in the sub $20,000 price range.
Oy, oy, oy.
So even I'm not going to be able to wangle a free one of those. That with a couple of lenses. Not going to be able to wangle
one. You might be able to get one on a loan for a week or two.
Exactly. So that's what I'm sort of hoping for.
Yeah.
But having seen the size of it in people's hands, I love it. The size is fabulous. Yeah.
It looks like quite a hefty monster.
Well, not really.
No, you don't think it's that big?
Well, not for people with big hands like me. That seems like apparently it's not that much bigger than a Canon 5D Mark whatever, you know?
Yeah, a
Nikon 810 or something.
I haven't seen it alongside something like that, but I did see a photo today of it alongside a Sony A7R II.
Well, if you go to the Facebook page of my mate Ken Kamineski, he's holding one in his hand on his profile picture.
Right.
So you can actually physically get an idea. And this guy's not very big. I mean that in the nicest possible way, Ken, if you're not listening. But and it doesn't look over. Yeah, once you actually see it in someone's hand, it doesn't look over the top big, which is good. So very, very, very functional. But the thing that got the most interest in my group is the Olympus OM-1ED Mark III, whatever, there's too many names.
Right.
Oh, EM-1 Mark IIED. Oh.
Quit now, man. Quit now.
The new Olympus. Here we are. The EM-1 Mark II.
Right.
Dot something or other. That's got a lot of people very, very interested.
Right,
along with the new 25mm 1.2.
Wow,
it's got people looking very excited for the new, waiting to see the new Olympus stuff show up. So,
so what size sensor is in that?
That's a micro 4/3.
Right, so that 25mm is going to be like about a 40mm in 35mm terms. So 50mm, exactly. Right? Yeah,
so exactly double.
Right.
So yeah,
even so 50mm 1.2, that'd be sweet lens.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, it's going to have the equivalent of about a look wise, I'm going to say an F2 lens in 35mm format, maybe.
Oh, okay. So aperture will likewise multiply out just like the focal length does.
Yeah. It's not so much it's the look as far as, so his example, someone was complaining
the numbers could be the same, but the look is different, right?
Exactly. So the people are saying about the new Fuji GFX, they're going, oh, yeah, but the best the lenses go down to is F2 and the 35mm cameras you get down to 1.2. And they're going, yeah, but dude, these bigger sensors, F2, looks like 1.2.
That's right.
So any given number, it doesn't correlate. So a 25mm 1.2 and a micro 4/3 is equivalent to maybe a 50mm, I'm going to say F2. Maybe 1.8.
Right.
But it's not going to look like a 1.2 lens, as an example.
Right, I see.
Because everything. So here's the thing. I say this at my understanding of your camera workshop as we've come full circle.
Yeah.
Yeah, because some people come with micro four thirds cameras, some people come with large cameras. I say every camera's got a compromise. And it's a matter of whether you can live inside that compromise.
Yeah.
So if you do lots and lots of macro work, as an example, a micro four thirds camera is going to be easier to use than a 35mm sensor camera.
Yeah.
Because it's larger apparent depth of field, say at f22,
yep.
Makes it easier to get your shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if you do lots and lots of portraits and want to blur out backgrounds,
yep.
That small sensor, it gives you less satisfying
bokeh.
The smell.
Yep.
Scratch and sniff. Yeah. And therefore, yeah, so maybe that's a compromise you don't want if you're going to primarily do portraits. So
yeah.
it's all that sort of pull and push, depending on what you're trying to do. Yeah. Everything's got compromises. Everything has limitations somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. So whilst I'm loving my Tamron 85mm 1.8,
yeah.
Love that lens to pieces, frustrating the living daylights out of me that I can't get closer than, say, 2.5 feet.
Right.
Which is fairly standard with portrait lenses. But after shooting with a 90mm macro for so long again,
yep.
You know, you're so used to be able to have no limitations to distance, minimum distance.
Yeah.
So everything's got compromises. And so whether you can live within those compromises is the key to sometimes what system's best for you.
Yeah. Cool.
And that was almost useful information at the end.
Almost.
Almost. We came within a bull's roar, but anyway.
That's right.
I guess we should talk to Chris. Well, by we, I mean you.
That's right.
You just wanted all the glory, didn't you? That's it.
No.
All about you. You didn't even ask me if I had any questions to ask him.
No, I didn't. That's a good point. I should have done that.
I wouldn't have had any. I'm the guy that, Craig. Bastard promised me a coffee about 6 months ago and I still haven't had it.
Right.
I had to get my own, Craig. I had to get my own. If you're listening, I had to get my own. Call me.
That's terrible.
Yeah. Anyway.
All right.
I want to go and feed this cat.
Okay, mate.
See, if it, just for the listeners, see if you can hear this.
I can hear that.
There's my little cat purring away on the lap. Say hello, everybody. Say hello, everyone. Come on, say hello. Say hello. His name's Flame.
Flame.
The kids named him Ginger Joe and Flame.
Right.
Yeah, as you do.
As you do. All right, mate. Well, you have a good week.
Well, you have a lovely chat with Craig.
I will do that.
Yeah. You know? And then my wife's away for the next 3 weeks, so don't expect this normal, sane, balanced guy you get in your normal every week workshop, whatever this thing's called, a podcast.
Yeah.
I may be a little bit more frazzled, a bit less rational, and maybe a little bit crankier than normal.
Right.
If it's possible.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll talk with you next week.
Bye.
See ya. Okay, so let's get Craig Wetchen on. Craig, welcome to Shutters Inc.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's all right. So we first heard about this project, a couple of years ago, I guess, and we mentioned it on the podcast at the time.
Yep.
In those couple of years, it seems like so much has happened in your world. Do you want to sort of take us on the journey? Like, take us right back to the beginning. How did this whole Men's Shed project come to be?
My Men's Shed project came to be through just the initial photo shoot of my father-in-law in his backyard shed. And I sort of talked about it with my wife at the time. And, you know, she's always known her dad as what he just loves to do and hang out in his shed. And so obviously I love photography and I was looking at a way of adding another element to my photography business, which was, you know, creating a historical memory piece photographically of, you know, an individual, a man in his backyard shed. And so I've ended up photographing quite a few friends, parents and grandparents for, you know, to start off and get some interest in it. And I was finding so much enjoyment in just the conversation, just as much as, crafting and creating a photograph.
Yeah.
And, so I just, I kept doing that for a little while. And then I sort of changed the project more from a money-making venture to more about the awareness of men's mental health and physical health just do with my issues with anxiety and depression, right, and, you know, some physical health conditions. Yeah. So then I just, I changed it to that standpoint, and it just continued to grow through word of mouth.
Right. So that was a question I was going to get to, was how did the tie-in with men's mental health come about? So you were suffering anxiety yourself. Was that to do with business, or was it more your personal life? Or
yeah, that was more from a business standpoint. Right. I was watching, you know, people not interested in, you know, paying for their photography for what I feel it's worth to charge. And and I was just really struggling with, you know, trying to keep the roof over my head and that love affair that I've always had with photography. And they usually say, don't mix, you know, your love of photography with money, because it can end in a disaster. And there you go.
Yeah, right. So here in Australia, we have men's sheds as a sort of a refuge in various communities. Is there any tie-in between your photography project and those men's shelters?
There wasn't as such at the beginning.
Right.
It was more about the men and their own personal backyard shed. And then, just through my research and involvement with Beyond Blue, I obviously came well aware of the Australian Men's Shed Association. And so through Jeff Kennett and talking with him and talking with Beyond Blue, I just felt it was just such a nice tie-in to my book with the Australian Men's Shed, just to continue that awareness. And I was finding more of the blokes in their backyards didn't even know it existed. And now a lot of them are actually involved.
Is that right?
Yes.
Wow. So what has been the feedback to you as a photographer from the community in general regarding the portfolio of images that you've created? And has there been much tie-in to the whole depression side of the story in that feedback?
Look, I think a lot of them just really related to, you know, I'm looking at the book right now, and the relationship between what, you know, my text component and some of the details and that documentary aspect. And they really found a great connection with the individual. And that was really the whole point of doing my project was showcase the connection photographically with the viewer. So when a viewer looks at the image, they can instantly relate to, you know, what the person does, who they are through the text. And it was just a really nice, it's a tough question on that, but I think everybody just really enjoys.
I didn't mean only from the guys that you photographed. I just sort of meant more, you know, family and friends of maybe the people that you photographed. What were their responses to the project in general?
Oh, their responses were, I guess it's hard to talk about what they say, because I don't want to sound like I'm self-absorbed or anything like that. But, you know, their general feedback is just that they've been so inspired by my persistence and tenacity in producing such a large volume of work.
Right.
And to just keep that straight and narrow with the whole plan and not give up.
Yeah, nice. I'm sure there have been numerous comments of, oh, you captured my husband, father, grandfather, uncle, whatever, in, you know, exactly the way I imagined him, type quotes. Were there any that said, wow, you captured a side of, yeah, this guy I've known for so long that I never knew existed?
No, everybody said that I've captured them exactly how they are and how they know who they are. So that was, for me, you know, that was a good testament to, you know, how I approached each of the photographs. You know, I approached each photograph more about the conversation and getting to know the person who's going to be in front of your camera and make sure they feel comfortable with me.
Yeah.
You know, most of the shoots usually took anywhere from 2 to 4 hours long.
Right.
So it was, you know, it was all about the conversation. And once they felt that sense of security and confidence in what I was doing, because I'm, you know, showing obviously genuine interest in what they were doing. And yeah, they were end up posing themselves. So I just
nice,
you know, I just I put a lot of effort into the lighting of the individual. You know, some of the sheds are quite dark, so I really wanted to emphasize the light for which you know you can craft an image with lighting an individual.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I obviously had on my list, being a photography podcast, that we would get around to discussing how you shot and how you lit and all that sort of stuff. But one of the questions I wanted to get to before I led into that was how much of the portfolio that you've created did you pre-visualize, or was it all just a case of, you know, going and meeting this bloke, seeing his shed, and then winging it?
Exactly what you just said.
Winging it.
Winging it. You know, it is, because I mean, I've never seen any of these sheds.
Right.
I never gone and scoped it out and then gone away and thought about it. So, and that's part of the conversation. You know, when I'm in someone's shed, you know, I'm looking at page 128, 129 in the book, Peter McQuiltar.
Right.
You know, we sat in the shed for a couple of hours just talking about things that are hanging up on the wall, why the pool table, where the license plates come from, you know, where did you find the give way sign? You know, all those sorts of little bits and bobs that these guys have in their shed. And when you're having that conversation and you're looking them eye to eye, and then you start talking about a piece, and then I'm being aware of the light and the environment, and I start pre-visualizing as we're talking where I'm going to place the individual and then how I'm going to place things in the background.
Yeah.
You know, such as 130 in the book, Peter McPherson and his aerial motorbike. You know, we moved I knew exactly where I wanted him. We moved the bike on an angle so it sort of sit right over his left-hand side, his right-hand side, camera left.
Yeah.
And not only that, it was lit. The bike was actually lit by window light.
Oh, lovely.
So all I had to do was, you know, light him. Right. So it was that, you know, finding that balance as well with some of the ambient light that's in there. And then, you know, the balance with the flash and that ambient.
So in general, how many speed lights or studio heads did you take with you?
I have a kit of 2 Canon 600s.
Mm-hmm.
I have a Canon 580, and I also have a Elinchrom Quadra Ranger battery pack.
Nice.
That I take with me, and I use the Quadra 2 heads and the 580 on a lot of the shoots, or I just use the 2 600s. On a lot of shoots as well. It just really depends on either how small the place is. Yeah. So one of the Canon shots would have flashes would have a softbox on it.
Right.
And the other would be, you know, I'd clamp it up on a, you know, up on the steel frame on the ceiling, in the shed. Cause you know, there's always, beams and things like that where you can clamp it. Just to add that little hair light, that backlight to create some separation.
And did you ever snoot anything to tighten a light at all, or are you just more about broad light?
Yeah, I snooted a few, but I think most of the backlight was just broad background light. And then I did, on my Elinchroms, I did use a honeycomb grid quite a bit.
Nice.
For the back hair light. So I honeycomb gridded that with the softball, with the Octobox on the subject.
Yeah, nice.
And there's quite a few images in the book that are just, you know, purely ambient light.
Yeah,
right. So just enough ambient light from, you know, a window or a garage door opening.
Yep.
And yeah, so I just sort of worked from there.
Beautiful. Now, I notice you've been doing a lot of media lately since the book has come out. You've been on The Project on Channel 10.
Yep.
Has that benefited the movement of the book, do you think?
I wouldn't know, to be honest. I know from a website standpoint, my web traffic spiked at nearly 300 to 400 visits after in within the hour of the project airing.
Wow.
So that was very interesting. So look, I don't know whether the media has affected the book. I know the book sales are going really, really well.
Excellent.
I think there was close to 1,500 books sold in the week before Father's Day, and then the week before that, there was another 1,500 books sold as well. So I think within the first month of the book being out, sold 5,000 books.
Nice work.
There's about 2,000 books left in the warehouse.
Right.
Out of 10,000.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, as I said, it was a bit of my journey, and it's a journey of, 101 men in their sheds and raising that awareness of, men's health and me using my photography as a tool, for connecting with an individual and then, connecting the individuals in the book and then hopefully, connecting the general public to the awareness of the Australian Men's Shed Association.
Nice. I was going to ask, how did the book deal come about? Like, was that a publisher who saw your work and thought there was potential for a book, or did you pitch the idea to them?
I pitched the idea to them.
Yeah,
so I was initially looking at doing a self-publishing, and I couldn't come up with $250,000 to self-publish. I don't know about you.
No.
Some people might have that kind of cash lying around. I certainly don't.
You needed to be Peter Lick to do that.
Yeah, that's right. So look, I had a friend of mine who's a photographer as well, Bill Backman. I don't know if you know Bill.
I don't.
He mentioned 5 Mile Press.
Right.
So I took a folio down to them with a nice leather bound album that I used to carry around as a folio, and pitched it to them, and they basically gave me a contract on the spot.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
So they obviously saw the value in it.
Oh, they saw the value, and I think Bill was just telling me last night that I don't like talking. I'm proud of what I've done.
Yeah.
But from what Bill said and what the publisher has also told me, that it's one of their most successful photographic books they've ever done.
Wow. Got to be happy with that.
I'm over the moon.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, to be almost, 10,000 books being almost sold within, 2 months is just,
fantastic.
I guess off the charts.
That is great. So are there plans to do a second volume?
I don't know about a second volume, because I think, you wouldn't want to, quote-unquote, depreciate the value of what the initial book stands for. So I'm looking at doing another iteration of this, but with a slightly different twist. And that's more around lost trades.
Oh, nice.
So trades that are almost non-existent.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that would be a great book and an interesting story to tell as well.
Exactly. So, and then my other book that I'm already starting is What Does Dementia Look Like?
Oh, okay. And that's a photographic book as well?
It'll be a photographic book with a series of 100 portraits of individuals, their families, what they do, activities, etc., and their story of people who have dementia.
Wow. Well, we look forward to seeing that.
Yeah, so do I.
On your website, you've got a buy the book page, which lists Booktopia, ABC Shops, Angus and Robertson, Book Depository, which is obviously international.
Yep.
David Jones, Dimmicks and Meyer.
Yep.
But I think I've seen you mention elsewhere that it's in Target or Big W now as well. Is that correct?
Yes, it's in Target, Kmart, Big W. Yeah.
Right.
It's everywhere.
So is there an ebook version of it, or is it purely a physical product only at this point?
It's a physical product only.
Excellent.
I'm a staunch believer in the printed image.
I was going to say, I'm with you on that.
I don't believe in one. I mean, I shoot in ones and zeros.
Yep.
Digitally, but you know, a print doesn't, a photograph doesn't come alive until it's printed.
Absolutely agree with you 100% there. Fantastic. All right. So if people want to follow you, Craig, where can they find you on the web?
They can find me at my, obviously my mensshedphotography.com.au webpage. I'll also have my businessphotographybydesign.com.au, which is going to be my, key, you know, website that's going to dovetail into all the other projects. You can follow me on Instagram at cwetch. You can follow me on Facebook on my Men's Shed project website there, a Facebook page there, Twitter.
Fantastic. I will make sure that all of those links for following Craig are in the show notes for this episode of Shutters Inc. So if you want to follow what Craig's doing, and certainly I'd be keen to see what you're coming up with next because they sound like interesting projects. But yeah. those details will be in the show notes for anyone that wants to check it out.
Yeah, I'm really, you know, as a photographer, you always got to continue to reinvent yourself.
Certainly.
I think, you know, personal projects always challenge yourself photographically. So, you know, thinking differently, keep motivating yourself, keep pushing boundaries with what you do photographically. So whether it's with how you light your subject.
Yep.
Because it doesn't really matter what camera gear you have, it's how you light them.
Absolutely. All right. The book is Men and Their Sheds, Photography by Craig Wetchen. It's available in all of the aforementioned bookstores. And for international listeners, you can get a copy through Book Depository. Craig, thank you very much for joining us on Shutters Inc.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Really appreciate joining you this morning.
Great to have a chat. And we will wrap it up with David Marlin's book review of the week. David, take it away.
Well, Bruce, you are right. Sooner or later, as a person who's keen on photographing landscapes, I'd have to talk a bit about Ansel Adams. As well as being a champion of national parks and the Sierra Club, Ansel was one of the founding members of Group F64, which was founded in the 1930s with a common style of sharp, focused, and carefully framed images from nature. In a way, this group was an opposition to the prevailing pictorialist style of the times. That style put more emphasis on creating an image with a lack of sharp focus to resemble painting, and printed in colours other than black and white, and the subjects frequently referenced nymphs and dryads. It was an attempt to have photography recognised as an art by making it look like art. Ansel and the other Group F64 members aimed to produce very precisely exposed images from nature. And given this emphasis on precision, it surprises many people that Ansel was a master of darkroom technology, dodging and burning his prints, but not to revert to the pictorialism, but rather to make up for the shortcomings of the technology and to ensure the print was reproduced as faithfully as possible what he saw. You see, we see a greater tonal range than a camera, and a print's got less tonal range than a negative. So the ability to produce prints that indicate a wide tonal range is an art in itself. As you'd expect, Ansel Adams' 400 photographs is dominated by his landscapes, particularly of national parks, each one of them precisely composed with great detail and tonal range. And to be honest, if that was all there was in the book, then it wouldn't be much to review because it's as expected. Most of his famous photographs are well known. They can be seen in many outlets. They can be seen in many places. But this book has some unexpected gems that are quite surprising and tell us a bit about why Ansel Adams was so successful. The pictures I'm using, for example, include a portrait of Alfred Stieglitz in his studio in 1939, a storeroom in a San Francisco museum, Still Life 1932, and Scissors and Thread 1931. These all show that Ansel had great skill in understanding how light works. For me, the epitome of his non-landscape photographs is that of the painter Gottardo Piazzoni. And I hope I've got that right. It depicts Gottardo at work in his studio. There is intense detail of the subject's smock, hands and face, deep in thought. And it contrasts with the partially finished work, and the light fades into unfinished form in the background. Ansel clearly understood light, and for me, it's these insightful pictures that help me understand more about how he made his landscapes and tells me more about things I need to learn. If you Google Ansel Adams 400 photographs, it ranges from about $44 to $56. Get it in hardback. It can be obtained from many outlets, including Australian ones. Cheers.
Thanks, David. How bizarre that I should have mentioned pictorialism in last week's episode. I guess I should have listened to all of your pre-recorded segments in advance, but I tend just to listen to the one that I'm going to include in each episode the week that we do it. And so I didn't realize that you were going to mention it, because it would have been good to tie the two together. But anyway, fantastic. Thank you very much once again. All right, well, Glyn's already said goodnight, and so I shall do the same, and we will talk with you again next week. Cheers.
ShutterZincPodcast.com.
AnotherAudioToYou.com quality podcast.
For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@ShutterZincPodcast.com.